He had found the quiet of the night very suitable for drawing out and using the necessary power to materialize himself. Though he did not realize what the actual time was. After talking it over with us, Fader agreed that it would be best to reserve any similar manifestations for when we were actually sitting for them, and this arrangement was adhered to from that time onwards. 107. Chapter 32, Some Difficulties Crop Up. The character of the phenomena now began to change. The attempts at materialization grew fewer, and most of the time was used for the development of the voices. Not only Fader but many other friends who had passed over came and talked to us again. Their evidence as to the personality of these friends was, at times, remarkably good, but depended to a very great extent on the conditions we could give them. Sometimes, when other people joined us in sitting, people who had little or no experience of physical phenomena, they would sit in a state of tension, apparently physically incapable of joining in the singing, or talking naturally when a voice addressed them through their trumpet. Previous to the sitting, I used to tell these new sitters to try and regard their whole thing as a meeting between friends, the friends who had gone over and their friends on this side. I told them to speak naturally if spoken to, but not to give away evidence, and they always promised to do so. In fact, seemed annoyed that I should think it necessary to prompt them to such an obvious line of conduct, but as soon as their sitting commenced, they seemed stricken with a kind of mental paralysis, which held up the whole seance, not only for them, but what was even more annoying, for us, too. I think that most people should go through a course of instruction before taking part in a seance of any type, but especially of the physical kind. During recent years there are many institutions, such as the London Spiritualist Alliance, the British College of Psychic Science, the W.T. Stead Borderland Library, where lectures are given and classes held, for the express purpose of preparing would-be sitters, so that they may learn how to behave at sittings and get the best out of them. This system of preparation is an excellent thing in more ways than one, because a certain number of people make up their minds that they would like to attend a seance simply because they have read about one, or Mrs. Somebody has told them about the remarkable results she has had with that wonderful medium, Mrs. So-and-so. It is sometimes with a desire to get a new experience, a new thrill, or simply out of curiosity, that this type of person approaches the subject, and I must admit that now and again they have made excellent sitters, and settled down to a serious study of psychical matters after having had a successful sitting or two. Some of them have become most useful and helpful members of the spiritualistic movement, but they have been few and far between. The majority of these casual investigators are often very disappointed with the results of their sittings, as they seldom bring the right conditions into the seance room, because their attitude of mind is not the right one. Sincerity of purpose is the one thing that counts more than anything in a sitter. Their guides sense sincerity, and appreciate it. The sincere skeptic makes a better sitter than the credulous, shallow person, so long as he recognizes that there are certain conditions that he must make allowance for, just as he would if he were investigating in 108. Any ordinary material field of research. I know nothing about chemistry, but I feel sure that an inexperienced person would not be invited into a laboratory and allowed to play ducks and drakes with anything he found there. And, on the other hand, he himself would not expect to be allowed to do so. He would be afraid of the consequences, yet he thinks he has the right to enter into the complicated and, so far, little understood field of psychic research, and enter the seance room, which is the laboratory of spiritualism, at random, and impose his own conditions irrespective of those laid down by the people who have patiently investigated the subject for years. The sitter becomes almost, perhaps quite, as important a part of a sitting as their medium, who has probably spent several years in developing and preparing himself. While in many cases the sitter blows in without any preparation whatever, a change is taking place, however, and everybody is recognizing the need for better instruction in these matters. This will lead to a higher standard of mediumship, and more satisfactory results all round. The controversy regarding physical phenomena waxes hot and stormy at times. So little have we explored and understood the conditions, difficulties and possibilities in the past, that now we do not always know how to judge the results. Some excellent and genuine phenomena are often condemned as being fraudulent because of some incomprehensible incident occurring in a séance, and at other times the most utter balderdash and obviously spurious results are hailed as marvelous. The outcome of all those most interesting séances in my own home was to convince me that it was too great a responsibility for me to cope with, in addition to my own psychic work, so my friends continued their development apart from me, the wife being helped by a responsible body of spiritualists who recognized the remarkable quality of her mediumship, and did their best to assist her in developing it on useful lines. 109. Chapter 33, A Joke Against Myself. I missed the sittings very much indeed, but Fader kept assuring me it was for the best. And my common sense told me I could not have gone on indefinitely spending so much time and energy on the psychical side of life alone, and plenty of other interests and duties came along which were important, but I often wished I could see Ab again, or hear him sing, or his sandaled feet doing their solemn and measured dance. One night, it was the beginning of winter, I went to bed, and feeling rather wide awake I began to read. Imagine my joy when I suddenly realized that there was a faint but unmistakable sound, suggestive of feet shuffling on the carpet, near my bed. I did not move for fear of disturbing any delicate psychic conditions that might have been carefully built up in order to produce some manifestation for me. My husband was fast asleep, as usual, so I whispered softly, "I hear you, whoever you are. Please, please, continue." In accordance with my wish, it seemed that the sound grew gradually louder, till I was quite certain it was not my imagination, but a real sound, as loud as we had heard in their seance when Abdullah rubbed his feet on the floor, keeping time to the music. It went on for about half an hour, then grew fainter and ceased. I did not say anything to my husband, as I felt he might want to stay awake and listen, too, which might alter the conditions by bringing too much concentration to bear on this new development of an old and favorite manifestation, because I hoped very much that the sounds were made by Abdullah, though, as yet, it was only surmise on my part. The next evening I took my book to bed with me again. My husband went to sleep. I lay on my back, my eyes on the opened page, trying to read quietly so as to maintain a passive condition. After a few minutes I heard a slight sound, then the unmistakable shuffling began. I noticed that there were slight pauses in between the swish, swish sound, and wondered if it would be possible for whoever was producing the sound to regulate it, and answer simple questions by making the swish sound three times in succession for yes and once for no, as Fader used to do with the bells, and the tilting of the table, speaking very quietly, so as not to disturb my husband. I put the above question and immediately received three distinct swishes in answer. I then asked if it was Fader manifesting though I somehow did not think it was, and the reply was one swish that I took to mean no. Then I said, "Is it Abdullah?" and at once heard three swishes. I was very pleased. Indeed, and though it may appear to be a rather restricted conversation when it is limited to yes and no only on one side, still it delighted me more than I can tell you. 110. To think that my old friend, Abdullah, had not forgotten me and had sensed my wish for a sign from him. I said, "Oh, Ab, I have missed hearing you very much." "Swish, swish, swish," says Ab. "Do you think you will be able to develop this sound onto more definite lines, Ab?" "Swish, swish, swish, very clearly and decidedly. It doesn't worry you, or disturb you. Doing this, does it?" "A strong, single, swish indicating no." "Ah, I don't want to do anything to hinder your progression. Don't come to me if it does hinder you." The reply was rather indefinite. "Anyway, Ab, you know how much I appreciate the trouble you have taken to come and see me, don't you?" Swish, 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 very loudly. I said a lot more, and swishes came in their threes and ones with astonishing exactitude and precision, dying away again in about half an hour's time as on the previous evening. Well, the following night the manifestation began again in exactly the same way. I took up my share of the conversation by welcoming Ab, but after I had made a few amiable and appropriate remarks, I began to feel rather stumped about providing any more intelligent questions that could be answered by a mere yes or number. A desire to know where Ab was standing, and the exact spot where he was rubbing his feet, came over me, so I asked, "Are you standing near the bed, Ab?" Swish, swish, swish. "Or near the table?" "One swish only." "Or near the towel rail?" Swish, swish, swish. Now the towel rail was not near the bed, so I was rather puzzled by this answer, and said, "Perhaps you don't know what a towel rail is, Ab, are you near the cupboard?" Swish, swish, swish. 111. This was more confusing than ever, as the cupboard was still farther away from the bed than the towel rail. "Ab," I said, "I don't think your idea of distance is very accurate." Swish, 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 in quick protest from Ab. Here I felt I simply must settle the question for myself, and I wondered if I could locate the sound better by leaving out of bed. I did so, and heard the sound, rather weaker than before, proceeding from somewhere near the foot of the bed. I got quietly out of bed, and you can imagine my feelings when I discovered that I had placed my stone hot water bottle on the floor. Immediately I had got into bed, and that the screw top was rather slack, causing there steam to escape in a succession of most convincing swishing sounds. Oh, there. Disappointment and disgust at my own credulity and lack of caution in investigating there cause of the phenomena. As it was the early part of winter, I had only commenced using the hot water bottle a few nights before, and the manifestation had begun that same evening. I think I kicked the hot water bottle before getting into bed again. However, my sense of the ridiculous overcame my disappointment, and I made up my mind to regard the incident as a necessary lesson in not accepting every unaccustomed sound as a sign from the other world. There are quite a large number of people who are inclined to do this, and I was amazed to hear one apparently sensible, hard-headed woman remark, when I told her the foregoing details as a joke against myself, "Oh, dear Mrs. Leonard, I am sure you were quite wrong in thinking that it was only the hot water bottle. I am sure it was Abdullah manipulating the screw of the bottle in a most clever and ingenious way in order to communicate with you. He moved the screw three times or once, according to the answer he wished to give you. Well, it may have been so. It may, but it isn't the kind of phenomenon that would appeal to the intelligence of the average man or woman who wants evidence of the reality of a spiritual world. At least, that is my opinion. Physical phenomena appeal to me most when they reveal the presence of an intelligent spirit entity behind them. When first one sees a definite movement of an object achieved by supernatural means, and by supernatural, I conclude that we mean something beyond or exceeding the powers or laws of nature, to use the dictionary definition of the word, one is certainly thrilled, even if it is just the elevation of a small table, as occurred in the first materialization seance that I attended. That which is called supernatural today will probably be called natural tomorrow, like their use of steam for locomotives and the carriages without horses, to quote Mother Shipton. The simple phenomena of the table and the more complicated and difficult materialization are all accomplished by the use of a natural power which at present we cannot locate, weigh, or measure at will, and, what is even more important, we cannot command. I think the latter difficulty may be because we are not producing their phenomena by our own volition. We have to rely on the unseen operator, their discarnate helpers, to manipulate the power which we provide. I feel sure this applies to all physical and mental phenomena. If we provide the power and the right conditions, 112. The other side will make use of them in a useful and evidential manner, if we give them time to do so. From my long and varied experience, I am sure that there are always a number of good, intelligent spirit people waiting eagerly for someone on earth to give them the chance of revealing their existence. It is all a matter of cooperation between the two conditions, the spiritual and the earthly. When people say, it is wrong to call up spirits, or we mustn't bring them back, it's bad for them, it is obvious that they have had no practical experience in this subject, or they would know that no amount of calling up would have any effect unless those who have passed over are willing, nay more than willing, to communicate, and even then we have to work and study hard so as to provide the right conditions, as I think I have shown you by my own and other people's investigations. No, establishing communication with the other side isn't an easy matter, and it won't be easy until we, on earth, are living higher spiritual lives, so that we are spiritually and mentally more attuned to those who have passed over. I must admit that I have known a few isolated cases where people of little or no spiritual development have contacted their other side, and developed psychical powers of a kind, and for a limited time, but it has not lasted. As soon as the other side realizes that the person on earth, after a fair trial, does not endeavor to progress because of his new knowledge and the privilege of intercourse with the spiritual world, they gradually withdraw from communication of their definite and personal kind, though they will continue to watch over, pray for, and surround the erring one with loving thoughts. 113. Chapter 34, How They Help Us in Times of Trouble. How many thousands of people could, if they chose, give accounts of the many ways in which their spirit friends have planned and arranged things for their benefit in times of difficulty? An example of the kind happened to me in December, 1924. My husband had always felt the coming of winter, and especially of the fog near London, very severely. At that time his chest and throat were much affected, and his general condition alarmingly weak. I did not know what to do, as we had had very heavy expenses in connection with other people whom it had been a duty to help, and the only obvious remedy for my husband was to take him away to the sea air, which always helps him. How to manage this, I could not think. Hotels and boarding houses are expensive and often too cold for an invalid, and the right diet is difficult to obtain. A few days away would be useless, it meant a month, at least, to be of benefit. One afternoon I had just finished giving a sitting. We were alone in the house, as I only had a daily help for the rough work for an hour or so in the morning, in order that there would be no noise caused that might interfere with my sittings. Feeling tired and anxious, I went into the dining room, picked up my little dog, Ching, and carrying her in my arms, I mounted the stairs rather unusually weary in body and mind. I quietly entered my husband's room, and found he was fast asleep, so I stood by the bedside looking down on him. He looked haggard and pale. In my mind was the thought, it's wrong to be anxious about anything, but oh, how I wish I knew what it was right to do. Would it be right to throw up all my engagements, thereby disappointing many people who might themselves be in greater trouble than mine, and also incurring heavy expenses, by taking my husband away, and, again, where could I take him? I had not the slightest idea. As these thoughts passed through my mind, I noticed my dog, who was still in my arms, turning her head to one side to watch something. On my right side, near the bed, was a table. On the table was a rather heavy white cloth, measuring about 3 feet square. I saw that it was at this cloth that my dog was looking so attentively, so I looked, too, and saw that the cloth was beginning to rise off the table, just as if somebody had got a stick or poker and inserted it underneath the cloth, so that the point of the stick came in the center, thereby raising the cloth in their exact shape of a tent. The cloth was raised very quietly and evenly until the edges almost, not quite, exposed the top of the table. Then it was lowered again just as 114. Regularly, until it lay as flat as before, without a crease or sign of the poke, I was astonished, but before I had time to begin to wonder what it meant, I mentally received an entirely unexpected message, as clearly as if the words were being shouted at me. It was to the effect that at that very moment something was being done which would solve my problem and difficulties about my husband, and the question of a suitable place for him. My worried feeling lifted instantly, like a cloud disappearing. I felt exhilarated and full of help again. I did not wonder from what source help would come. I only knew it would come, and that if I waited a very little while I should understand. The next morning a letter arrived from Mrs. Vale Owen, wife of the Reverend Vale Owen, whom I had only met once or twice, but to whom I had written a couple of days previously saying that I was sorry not to be able to arrange a meeting as we had hoped to do, as my husband was not well, but I would write again later when he was better. The reference to my husband was only a slight one, as I did not want to worry people with our troubles. As soon as I opened Mrs. Vale Owen's letter, I knew it was the solution of my difficulties that I had been promised. After expressing sympathy about my husband's indisposition, Mrs. Vale Owen wrote, "We have just had a visit from a Mr. Alfred Morris, whom you have never met. He came to tea this afternoon, and we talked about you. I felt strongly impressed that I must read your letter to him, though I did not know why, except that he had said he was interested in your work, and when I read the part referring to your husband not being well, Mr. Morris mentioned that he had a delightful furnished house vacant on his private estate by the sea, and would I write to you and ask if you would like the loan of it for a few weeks or longer?" Mrs. Vale Owen sent me several photographs of the house, in which she and her family had stayed for some time, and it was indeed a most charming and attractive place, standing in picturesque grounds such as one rarely sees so near the sea. I was full of gratitude, as I knew that our unseen friends had brought about the whole thing. The long and short of it was that we paid a visit there of over a month. My husband became well again, and it formed the basis of a most happy and helpful friendship which still continues, and many other important links have been formed through this marvelously arranged visit. On comparing notes with Mr. Morris, I found that his kind offer of the home was made to Mrs. Vailoin at approximately the time I saw the cloth rise from the table, and received the clear mental message that help was coming to me in my difficulty. This is only one example among many that I could quote as indicating the loving care with which one is surrounded by friends in the invisible world. But there is one thing that one must not do, and that is demand, or even expect, help from our spirit friends in their material things of life. One must do one's utmost, no matter how many difficulties, or how heavy the burden, as far as one is spiritually, mentally and physically able. When it comes to the point that one is, apparently, powerless to do more, then our unseen 115 helpers step in and give a hand. There are times when we have to undergo severe sorrow and trouble in order to learn a lesson that we cannot, or have shown ourselves unable to, learn in any other way. Then, even those who love us best over the have to stand aside and watch us going through it. Even so, we are not alone, their thoughts of love and sympathy must and do help us, even when we are staggering and stumbling blindly through the pain and difficulty that may be the only means of strengthening and purifying us. Let thy gold be cast in the furnace, thy red gold precious and bright. Do not fear the hungry fire with its caverns of burning light. For gold must be tried with fire, as a heart must be tried by pain. A. Proctor. Sometimes, when persons begin a course of psychic study with the object of developing their own powers, they find that they are severely tried by reverses of a material nature, or suffering in some form, and are inclined to resent it. The words of C.H. Spurgeon, "The Lord gets his best soldiers out of the highlands of affliction," would apply to them. Some people seem to come through more likely than others, but I think all are tried according to their measure and capacity. 116. Chapter 35. Some Wonderful Phenomena. At one time I would have given anything to have been able to develop physical mediumship instead of the mental. Perhaps it was because my very practical mind demanded such concrete proof before I was convinced myself of the truths of spiritualism that gave me the idea that other people would be more likely to believe something they could objectively see, hear and handle for themselves. Now, looking back, I am glad that the guides advised me to develop mental mediumship alone. Because I am sure, from different experiences, and from what we have been told by our spirit helpers, that they themselves are sometimes at sea in our physical conditions, which are no longer theirs, and which middle dot they can only contact and function in at certain times and under certain conditions. What these conditions are, we do not always know ourselves, but they appear to be very difficult to regulate. I also think that there are some people over there who are suited to the mental vibrations of Earth, and others who can contact the physical ones as well. I have noticed that two entirely different types of people will take part in one manifestation, as if one set were taking charge of the intellectual or mental side of the operation, and the other set applying themselves to the physical or material part. When my little dog, Ching, passed over, I was taken in my sleep to see her. She appeared to be leading an ordinary doggy life in the spirit world, and to be happy. The first time I saw her, she was rather puzzled at my having to leave her again, and looked as if she would like to run after me, but knew that she must not. I was pleased that I had seen her in her new home, but thought I would like to see her occasionally in my earthly house.